Tight budgets, accountability, organizational restructuring. It may sound like IBM, but we're talking about America's colleges and universities. On this edition of Conversations, Russ Edgerton. He's the president of the American Association for Higher Education, and he'll take a look for us at the hallowed halls of academia and ways they may be changing. Russ, thanks for joining us.
Nice to be here, Susan.
Good. Glad to have you with us. It seems like everything is more expensive these days, but one of the things we hear a lot about, like the high cost of healthcare, for example, is the high cost of education. From your point of view as a watcher of higher education, is college getting more and more and more and more and more expensive like healthcare is, or is that perceptual only?
Well, it's clearly getting more and more expensive for the consumer,
yes,
for the students and the parents. And there are a couple of reasons for that. Throughout the decade of the 80s, the cost of higher education and tuitions rose about double the rate of inflation, especially in the private sector. And since the 1990s began, the states have been privatizing higher education in a major way. So that states under increasing pressure on a number of budget fronts and the economic retrenchment in general have been passing much more of the costs of attending college on to parents and students in off-state budgets. For example, in California, which is probably the most dramatic story of almost breaking the sort of historic compact between the public and giving access to higher education, the California State College and University System has raised tuition about 85% in 2.5 years. The University of California at Berkeley, 9 campuses, including Berkeley and UCLA, have raised tuition 45% 1 year. I think it was like 30 the next year. So the consumer, the parents and the students are paying a good deal more for their higher education than they were, in part because the costs are rising, in part because the states are not picking up the share that they used to. Some states like University of Wisconsin, in the state of Wisconsin, I think the state only pays about 20% now of the costs of the University of Wisconsin. It used to pay 35%, and that story is happening all over.
So one of the things that is happening and probably comes as a surprise to students and to parents, whoever is paying the cost of education, is that students are now going to be paying closer to the real costs of their education.
That's right. I mean, again, California is a good story because there was a famous master plan in 1960 in California that really committed the state to a low-cost public access system. And community colleges could be attended for a very modest tuition, and the state college system for another tuition, and the Berkeley system for a third higher tuition, but all the tuitions were relatively low, and now all that's changed.
This is in the optimism of what truly was another economy.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Do we have, in a nutshell, here the explanations for the cries for accountability, then, that we're hearing?
Well, I think you have part of the story.
Good. What's the other part?
And I think that your original analogy with the healthcare system is a good one. I think, in 1990, when the healthcare issue became a major campaign issue in Pennsylvania, the sort of dynamic underlying that issue was that people had a sense that a service was ever more desperately needed on the one hand, and ever less affordable on the other. Mm-hmm. And if you have a sense that there's something you need desperately, but you can't afford, you've got a tinder for a public issue. And in the case of higher education, the subtle thing that's happening, it seems to me, is that it's no longer the case in our country that a high school degree can lead to a good life. Since 1974, the middle class has been downwardly mobile. And we used to have, put differently, we used to have a two-track economy in which you could go to college and go on to a decent standard of living, or you could get a high school degree or even not have a high school degree and still earn a decent standard of living.
In the trades.
In the trades, right. Or in, you know, in so-called non-college type work, mm-hmm. manufacturing jobs and so on. And as we all know, those non-college type jobs have been eroding. And we deluded ourselves throughout the 80s that it wasn't happening with the borrowing binge and lots of other things about that era that just masked the underlying reality of a fundamental change in the American economy. I think in 1990, with the election of President Clinton and that whole campaign, people in all regions and all classes had a deep sense that something was different, mm-hmm. that the sort of American dream was slipping away, and they woke up with a shock that we lived in a different world. The translation to higher education, back to your original question, is that people feel that a college degree is ever more essential. At the same time, we all have sons and daughters that are college graduates who are themselves having a hard time getting a toehold in the economy, but they're certainly in a lot better shape than people that don't have it. So in addition to the sort of sense that, the dynamic here is that like healthcare, college is perceived as sort of ever more important as a gateway to success. And yet at the same time, because of all these tuition rises and so on, it's ever less affordable. Mm-hmm. I don't think that the public feeling about higher education has the same power as the healthcare issue by any means, but it's similar and it's lurking there. And I think out of that comes the pressure we're feeling by academics generally, for higher performance, doing more with less. Why aren't the faculty able to pay more attention to undergraduate teaching and all those pressures that I'm here talking about, the University of Alaska at Fairbanks?
This is Russ Edgerton, who's with us. He is the president of the American Association for Higher Education and is a guest of the University of Alaska Fairbanks in April of 1994 to talk about the future of higher education from a faculty perspective. This is Conversations, and I'm Susan McInnes. I want to look at this question of accountability from a couple of different angles. It seems to me that in the what we think of as the healthcare crisis, people are arguing that the service isn't there, that doctors are getting fat off the land, that not everyone has access. There's a lot of different mm-hmm. criticisms. Mm-hmm. Do you see criticisms of the way we're educating people as well as just the need to tighten budgets, change the way the organization works? Is it service delivery mm-hmm. or is it the service that's mm-hmm. being delivered?
I would distinguish the general public from the governing constituency that deals more sort of directly with higher education affairs, and my answer to that question. I've seen survey data about the general public that suggests that it's really the degree and getting the degree that's important, and the affordability of the degree, and there isn't a widespread or deep understanding about what goes on in the course of getting the degree, frankly, not a whole lot of interest in political correctness or even athletic abuse or a lot of these sort of press stories about the higher education administrators are having to deal with. The general public has a well of faith in the importance of higher education, respect for the faculty, a general sense of that it's a good institution, and they want access to it.
And that means that if I have that degree, that I have
you have something important.
I have something important. It means that I can back
right.
it up. Okay.
Right.
Thanks.
But the general public, you know, in other words, is most concerned about the degree and its affordability. When you go to the legislators, business, corporate leaders, the leadership segments of the society, I think you get a very different message. And these people are, you know, in the case of the business community, they've restructured. They've gone through very tough times, and they're asking the question, well, now we've done it, why can't you? Legislators have now spent a decade deeply immersed in the affairs of school reform and trying to improve the K-12 system. And a number of them have gotten rather sophisticated about what a quality education is all about. And they're beginning to ask questions, well, if schools should behave in these certain ways, and we now know what an effective education is, and it has something to do with, you know, sort of powerful encounters between teachers and students. And we look at colleges and universities, and we find that, as the state of Arizona did, that 7 out of 10 courses in the freshman and sophomore years are taught by teaching assistants in the University of Arizona. They begin asking, well, is that what we're paying for? And, mm-hmm. and why can't, where are the faculty? So I think there's a difference. And I think that the attentive public and the governing constituents are the principal source of the demand for higher performance, quality, more quality, more productivity in particular. The general public concern about affordability and cost is sort of the platform for that. But I don't think that the general public is sort of as much into that set of concerns.
Mm-hmm. This is too big a question, so just to answer a little part of it, and then we'll go on from there. Mm-hmm. How right are the governing bodies? How accurate are they? When you look at the university, do you see an inefficient, out-of-touch TA taught experience?
Well, let me answer that with an analogy to the school situation. I think it's hard to sort of say something is, you know, at a level of quality or not without looking at what the sort of, you know, where the goal line is, where the bar is. For most of this century, we had a school system in which, unlike the European countries, who had sort of different institutions, apprenticeship programs, vocational programs, and then other institutions called high schools, to serve their students. We had all of our students in a common institution called the common school. But if we look inside that school, we found that there were three very distinctive tracks. There was a vocational track and a general track and an academic track, and only a small portion of the students that graduated from high school were really products of that academic track of mm-hmm. rigorous study of academic subjects. And that all worked as long as people that graduated from the general track and the vocational track could find work and be productive citizens. But now, in a fundamentally changed economy, it's no longer sufficient for someone to graduate without, you know, high-level abilities. I mean, people offloading trucks need to look at the inventory schedule and punch in data on a computer and so on. The world has changed in a fundamental way. So that means that the standard of performance, what society needs to expect of schools, has changed dramatically. And we need to have all students, not just a third of the students, graduate at a standard where at least by the 10th or 11th grade, everybody has a common academic rigorous track, because that's the way the world is. So it's not that, you know, that schools are good or bad, independent of, you know, what the society needs in terms of the people who graduate. And I'd say the same thing about higher education. I think, you know, the standard line of all university administrators is that higher education is the envy of the world, our system, and we have people from all over the world come to study in our institutions. So from that point of view, higher education is doing fine. But if you look at the character of the 21st century and the demands and needs of our society, I would argue that higher education has to change in fairly fundamental ways, and that therefore there is a validity to the demands for improvement and accountability and higher performance. And I think higher education is beginning to respond to those demands.
The American Association for Higher Education perceives itself as kind of the Paul Revere of education. That's on a piece of paper you mm-hmm. sent to me. If you're aware of this need for fundamental change, where do you think the rest of us are in the nation in terms of that understanding, both the citizenry and academia? Are we getting the glimmer that things need to change?
I think so.
Or are we ahead of that?
Well, I think that, again, I'm in terms of the leadership of the country, the business community, the political community, I think that there's an awareness of and a demand for restructuring, for higher productivity, for higher quality. And I think within higher education itself, that message is beginning to come through. And there isn't anyone in any institution that enjoys change. And higher education is no different from any other institution. It's hard. It's mm-hmm. painful. Mm-hmm. But I see signs all over the country of conversations underway and looking at the reward system in a different way, making teaching more central, paying more attention to undergraduates. And so I think the system is beginning to respond. Again, back to your healthcare analogy, I think that in healthcare, I'm going back to your sort of multi-part accountability problem. Part of the problem in healthcare is access. We have, what is it, 30 million people without insurance that can get healthcare. Part of the issue in higher education is continued access and making higher education more affordable and more accessible. In California, there are 200,000 fewer places today for students than there were 3 years ago. That's striking.
Fewer chairs, seats.
Fewer available class seats.
Wow.
Because of capping enrollments. In a state in which between now and the year 2006, given the demographics and immigration, there will be a 50% increase in demand for going to college. And so there's a powerful demand for access, and there's an important access issue. But there's also an issue of productivity. And just as in healthcare, I believe the leadership of the society is pretty well agreed that the balance between specialists and general practitioners is sort of out of whack, that there are, you know, if we had our druthers, instead of having about 75% of the doctors who are specialists studying esoteric specialties and providing, highly technical surgery and so on, and 25% of the doctors who are general practitioners and providing primary care, the balance might be 50-50 or a different kind of balance. And similarly in higher education, I think that the kind of governing constituency feels that we have, on balance, probably more faculty that are teaching highly specialized courses, spending time with graduate students, doing research, and not enough faculty who are worrying about undergraduate education, freshman, sophomore year experiences, dealing with students who are really having tough problems but need to be educated. And there's a similar issue there.
Let's take that similar issue a step farther. It seems to me that the general practitioner who attended you when you were a boy and who attended me a decade later when I was a girl is not the general practitioner who is going to, or let's say he doesn't, she doesn't have the same body of knowledge then that they would have in the 1990s. Isn't that also true of a college professor / general practitioner, that we're going to be demanding very different things of that teacher than we might have 20 years ago? Spin that one out for me a little bit. Mm-hmm. Do you see a difference in that professor, if we pull mm-hmm. that professor out of research and out of mm-hmm. specialization? What is he, what does she look
and
like?
And I, by the way, am not, I don't mean to say that, you know, I'd be the first to say that basic research is crucial and that we need a strong research capacity and so on. So I don't want to be on the side of those who don't think that research is fundamentally important. I certainly do. But I do think that that the kind of professor, the kind of role of a professor in the undergraduate experience in the next century is going to look different than this century. And it grows out of, I think, fundamentally a shift in what it is that students themselves need to learn.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's more and more the case that any subject knowledge that we learn has a half-life or a quarter-life in a world of very rapid change. The most fundamental things to learn are not any particular sort of substance, but the ability to think, to communicate effectively, to reason, to solve problems in the context of these subject matters. So that abilities of a high level to keep on learning
mm-hmm.
Are ever more important and becoming more important than the particular stuff of the subject matter itself. Way back in, I think it was 1828, a report at Yale made a distinction between the furniture and the discipline of the mind. And what I'm saying is that the discipline of the mind is ever more important, and the furniture of the mind is keeps changing. And what that means when you think about the role of a professor is that, you know, we can teach knowledge about things by telling students about them, but we want to teach students how to do things. It's different, and students learn how to do things by doing them.
Mm-hmm.
So the role of the professor changes from becoming a dispenser of knowledge, being a dispenser of knowledge, to the designer of tasks that students perform, and then a coach and an assessor as to how those tasks are being performed. That's a very different role. And when you throw in what we're learning about the importance of collaborative and group learning the importance of learning how to work with teams the sort of importance of collaboration in general as a key to success. And when you throw in the coming online of all kinds of new communication technologies that ought to be facilitators of the teaching learning process, I think we can, I don't think we quite envision what it's going to look like out there, but I think it's pretty clear that the role of the professor is no longer a source of knowledge and authority as much as a facilitator of the learning process and a designer of tasks and a coach, and that's different.
Mm-hmm. Russell Edgerton is with us today on Conversations. He's a Stanford graduate, and following that he took his PhD from Columbia University. His background is in political science, his PhD in public law and government. He worked at the University of Wisconsin at Madison for a number of years as an assistant professor, and then went into the design of education, first in the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, working for HEW from 1969 to 1977, and now with the American Association for Higher Education, an association that sees itself, as I said, as the Paul Revere of higher education, looking out for the need for change and then discussing it with their peers. I'm Susan McGinnis, and this is Conversations. If the professor is going to be asked to change, then the way teachers are taught to teach has to change. Isn't that so? Is that the biggest change you see on the horizon, is that aspiring professors will need to learn how to teach differently?
Well, I think that's one of the changes. And I think there are some things in the course of earning one's PhD that could be changed. But I think generally that learning to teach is a matter of learning from experience. What fundamentally needs to change, in my view, is that faculty need to spend a lot more time talking to each other about the character of their teaching and what's going right and what's going wrong in the classroom, and make teaching as lively a subject of intellectual discourse as their research. And we see signs that that's too happening. Teaching needs to become a scholarly collaborative activity. That's the message that I've been sort of touting since I arrived here in Fairbanks.
The logical question for me is, why isn't it? What makes teaching something that's not talked about?
Well, I think part of it is that that one of the traditions of teaching that's emerged in the academy that came out of schools of education and departments of psychology is to think about teaching only as a matter of technique, only as a matter of giving a clear lecture, knowing how to organize a discussion group, giving students good marks on their final exams, writing back to the students about the final exams, and all those presentational skills are very important indeed in terms of the quality of teaching, but they're not things that smart, bright faculty members think are particularly interesting to talk to each other about. And we've had a kind of view of teaching as technique that I think has been demeaning of the true complexity of what teaching is all about. And if we can sort of resurrect a deeper and richer view of teaching, not only as technique, but as a matter of the rich and important ways in which someone can explain a difficult subject to their students in terms that the students can understand it, and resort to metaphors and analogies and demonstrations and ways to connect an idea into the minds of their students, and talk more about those kinds of dimensions of teaching, which I call the scholarly dimensions of teaching. The intellectual interest of faculty in the subject of teaching would sharply increase. And I don't think that this particular dimension of teaching I'm talking about is much different from public discourse about any issues. I mean, it's effectiveness in communication and explanation. We all know political leaders who have a gift of putting things in a powerful way, of creating images which stick with people. I remember I'm a political scientist, as you said, and I remember reading Sherwood and Hopkins, Robert Sherwood's book about the Roosevelt era, and how when Roosevelt, on the edge of World War II, was struggling to explain to the American people what Lend-Lease Act was all about, and he went off on this ship for 3 days and just brooded, and came back and had one of his famous fireside chats and said, "Well, now, if your neighbor's house is on fire, and you have a length of garden hose, what would you do?" And once he gave the American public an image of a very difficult, complex program of Lend-Lease as a matter of lending your garden hose to a neighbor whose house was on fire. He communicated something powerful about that in an important way. And that's what professors do, who take a difficult idea of calculus and find a way to put it in terms that their students can grasp it. Probably the most famous teacher in America is Jaime Escalante, the marvelous Hispanic fellow who's created about a quarter of the students who pass the AP exam in calculus in the whole country. are his students in one high school in the East Barrio of Los Angeles. If you visit Jaime Escalante's classes, as some of people I've talked to have, they tell me that in the first day of class, he talks about calculus with the analogy of the L.A. Lakers basketball team. Learning the rules of calculus is like learning basketball, calculus to basketball, basketball, calculus. And I'll tell you what, the students from the East Barrio know the L.A. Lakers. And he can put a difficult subject in those terms. Well, that's what, in part, powerful teaching is all about. And if faculty talked about those kinds of dimensions of teaching, I think that we'd have a livelier, richer discussion within the academy about teaching.
Because these, quote, tricks would not belong to the geniuses of teaching, but would be techniques to enrich the art of teaching generally as they're passed across faculty lines. Is that what you're looking at?
Well, I'm looking at just a way to think about teaching as not simply a matter of skills of how to manage classes, but of deep understanding of your subject and a capacity to come out of that specialized deep understanding and put things and say things and demonstrate things in ways that connect. And to do that, you have to know your subject very fundamentally. You have to really understand it. Aristotle used to believe that teaching was the highest form of understanding. That the people who knew something so well that they could turn around and teach it were special people.
Did we lose that somewhere along the way?
I think so. I think what happened as departments of education and psychology evolved, they organized themselves around the sort of techniques of teaching, teaching in general, the general methods that work for someone, whatever the subject is that's being taught. So that when students, if we go to the teacher education programs in our country that are part of a lively discussion, students, that go through those programs are subjected to a lot of sort of general techniques, but they're independent of a deep understanding of the subject field itself. And I think a number of people are beginning to believe more and more that we need to have people within teacher education programs who understand math, who understand biology, who understand English, and then have these general techniques of presentation and classroom management. But there's a lot more to teaching than simply knowing how to keep a class disciplined and knowing which students to call on and knowing how to use audiovisual aids and this sort of thing.
And teaching Chaucer is not teaching physics, is not teaching these things are
right.
Distinct.
Right.
Yeah. Russ Edgerton is with us on Conversations. I want to ask you about perceptions of students today. There, you can pick up an American newspaper and read that America's entering college students can't read well, can't write well, can't do math well, won't do science. This seems to be a stereotypic image. Where's the truth and where's the pessimism here? What do you believe about America's students?
Well, I think we have a couple things going on. On a number of particular measures of performance in elementary and secondary schools, throughout the 70s and early 80s, things got worse, and then things started getting better. for example, student capacities in sort of basic skill levels have increased in important ways for quite a number of years now.
That's the reading, writing, arithmetic.
Yeah, basic skills.
Yeah.
The story is a little bit different in terms of higher level skills. But you know, you could argue that for some period now, the in terms of some of the actual measurements of student achievement, things are actually getting better. But at the same time, as I said earlier in the program, the expectations mm-hmm. for what is needed are escalating, and the information about the actual capabilities and qualities of students is much more newsworthy. And so we're, I think, more aware of the sort of negatives and the problems and the gap between where we need to be and where we are than we are the sum of the evidence of the sort of slow and steady progress of actual achievement. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of both half full and half empty.
And where do you think colleges are in terms of preparing to accelerate students on those issues?
Well, I think that the primary focus of public concern and the primary response on the whole issue of American educational reform has been heavily centered on the school system. And there's lots of things to talk about and lots of action that's taken place in the schools. And the schools have, there is a deep and now decade-long school reform movement underway in this country.
Elementary and secondary.
Right. I think higher education has been somewhat apart from all that and is gradually becoming under public scrutiny, is gradually being perceived as part of the whole system that needs to change. And is gradually seeing itself as coming under the goldfish bowl of public scrutiny and needs to get its act together and so on. For example, the legislation on Goals 2000 that just passed the American Congress, the Goals 2000 legislation. Has one of its goals, Goal 5, directed at higher education. And there's an expectation in that goal statement that says that by the year 2000, there will be substantial improvement in the capacity of college and university students to write, solve problems, and communicate effectively. That's the only one of all those national goals that's directed specifically at higher education, and it's only a subpart of Goal 5. So it's sort of an indication that higher education's to some extent been left out of the last decade of concern, but now is attention is turning to it. And Governor Romer, the governor of Colorado, who's now the incoming chair of the Education Commission of the States, one of the organizations in the country that represents all the governor's interests in education, is making higher education the subject of his year in office, and wants to raise questions about where is higher education in all this. So it's sort of an indication of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, then let's take a look at this changing institution. When we take a look at a college degree now, mm-hmm. we think of a four-year education, general credits, a specialty declared at some point, a certain number of courses you have to take, certain number of times and hours sitting in the chair, and then you kind of emerge 4 years later out of the system prepared to do something that may be general or may be specific. If you look down the road 20 years from now, do you see this reconfigured? And do you see, maybe this is better for the purpose of you answering, do you see signs that this configuration is beginning to change?
Well, I see two things. I see Merkley, some glimpses of what I'd like to see happen, some sort of images and visions of what a powerful education out down the road out there in the future would look like. Whether or not we're going to get from here to there, I think depends on a lot of things that are hard to predict, including the willingness of the American public to become captivated by those visions and support higher education in the future, and so on. Change and reform also requires money. and to realize the more dramatic visions of what a future might look like, there needs to be support for those processes of change. Let me give you one real example from the past about that. About 25 years ago, at McMaster's University in Canada, the medical school decided that that it didn't make any sense to sort of stuff 2 years of basic science down the into the heads of prospective doctors, and then turn them into clinical practice and call that a medical education. From the very beginning of their entrance to medical school, doctors should be challenged with problems, work in teams on those problems. The medical staff should be in the role of being a resource to those teams. And when they couldn't, when they needed guidance as to what literature to go to or how to frame an issue or whatever, the staff were there to do that. So they dramatically changed the vision of how a medical educational experience should take place.
Can I ask you, did the basic science get in there along the way?
Well, it got in there, but it all got in there only as things you needed to turn to in order to understand how to solve this problem.
Okay. And there weren't awful gaps?
There weren't awful gaps. Okay. I mean, it worked. Mm-hmm. Well, 20 years later, Harvard University's medical school decided that that was a great idea and that that model was a model that they wanted to try out. So they created a program they called the New Pathways Program. But they couldn't and didn't simply say, okay, to their entire medical school, we want to pursue that new path. They took a small cohort of students. Mm. And a handful of faculty and said, we're going to create an experimental program. We're going to create a new pathway. But a percentage of our students that are entering our school will take that new path, and a percentage of the faculty will figure out how to do things in a very dramatically different way. And for about 5 or 6 years, they ran, in effect, a dual program. They ran the traditional program, and then they ran a new program. And they studied it and evaluated the new program very intensively. Mm-hmm. And then they decided the new program is terrific, and we ought to convert the whole medical school, or a large part of it, over to the new pathway, which they're in the process of doing. But in that intervening period, they needed resources both to continue the traditional program and to invent the new program.
Very expensive.
And that's expensive. What I find sort of lacking in terms of the response of higher education to the 21st century glimpses of how things might be different are in part the visions, but also in part the resources to take cohorts of students and cohorts of faculty and fundamentally do things differently, and then look at whether or not quality does improve, and convert from the old to the new. And in all of the talk of restructuring and higher productivity, and so on, at the same time that demands are increasing, at the same time that accountability pressures are increasing, the actual availability of resources in state and federal budgets for improvement is decreasing. And that's hard. And it's hard, as we all know, to both downsize and reinvent and be creative at the same time. And so I think we need to find a way both to sort of I mean, people don't change unless they have to. The external pressure for change is important, and I wouldn't sit here and say that higher education is going to change without external pressure to do so. I think it takes that, but it also takes, once that pressure is there, both vision, courage of leadership, and the resources to make those difficult changes. Mm-hmm. And whether or not the resources will be there, whether or not the vision will be there, whether or not the leadership will be there, I don't know. I see signs, elements, hopeful indications, but I think it's too early to tell.
Do you think the public will ever cry for this change? It seems to me, I'm going back to your thought earlier in the hour, that the public's pretty well satisfied that a bachelor's degree is important mm-hmm. and a master's degree is important, and mm-hmm. they are valuable pieces of paper as they are. So it seems to me from what you're saying that the clamor for change won't come right. from the outside, so therefore funding won't right. follow.
Well, I think the clamor for doing more with less will come from the outside. But the visions and the designs need to come from the inside and from the leadership, and should. It's not the outside in the healthcare situation that's re-envisioning what an HMO really ought to look like. People that are the responsible professionals have to do that, and in the case of higher education, the responsible professionals have to do that.
Here's a practical question. When we take a look at the example of Harvard recreating its medical school, the students who were lined up to join that program, it seems to me, already knew they wanted to be doctors. In terms of revolutionizing the academy in general, many students, whether they're 18 or 19 years old, or midlife students returning to college, don't know what they want to specialize in. Some amount of time, maybe even a year or two in college, is spent knocking around. I don't know, English, physics, geography, political science. Where are my interests? How does the college of the future, if it takes people right into task, deal with that student who may still be making decisions about the next stage of his or her life?
Well, I don't think that taking students into tasks means that that the education curriculum needs to be prescriptively vocational or career-oriented or so on. Let me give you an example. At Oberlin College, professor of environmental studies teaches a course by engaging students in a major ecological project of looking at Oberlin College itself as an ecological system, and asking questions about where the food sources come from and who are the suppliers and where does the material for the buildings of this place come from, and looking at the whole environment from a perspective of ecology and a perspective of an environmental agenda. And the students are deeply engaged in looking at, can we run the cafeteria in a better way or this or that. They came out of that course with an awareness of environmental issues that they didn't have, with abilities to do analysis, with an active sense of how to scurry around and get data and evidence about a social problem. All of those things are relevant to a lot of potential careers and courses of study that they might go into. So the course, the project itself, teaches things that are terribly valuable and important, but it doesn't necessarily steer them in any particular kind of career direction. And in my envisionment of a college undergraduate education in the future, if more students were engaged in that kind of active learning, problem-solving process, be it doing studies in their community, be it doing work in a science lab, but more hands-on, activist kinds of research and work. That's the kind of, you know, of education that we need to provide. But it's not. It doesn't mean that the students that do that have to sort of go into any particular field.
The other thing I hear you saying is not only holistic, not only hands-on, but real-world experience, which answers one of the questions people have about academia, is that it may be out of touch with the world, quote, as we know it. What's your thoughts on academia in touch, out of touch with the world that college graduates enter?
Well, I think that it's easy for any professionals, and I think a number of academicians have slipped into this dilemma of seeing their subject as an end in itself, and kind of assuming that, be it political science or whatever the subject is, that students should be motivated to learn it, and once they have them in class, they talk about the subject rather than the problems that society confronts and how the subject relates to those problems. I think that powerful teaching does need to use as a point of departure the interest that students bring to the class. Mm-hmm. And I think that a number of the sort of exciting things that are going on in higher education are organized around interdisciplinary problems. We have examples of entire universities like Portland State University in Portland that are organizing curriculum around issues like child development and crime and poverty and ecological studies, and drawing faculty from different subject matter departments to engage in the teaching of those subjects and the research about those subjects. And I think that sort of thing is going to happen more and more in the future, and I think education will be more exciting because of it.
Mm-hmm. And student willingness, student excitement about these avenues, is it there? Is it present?
I think so. I think students, it's hard to generalize about students. There are many, many kinds and shapes and sizes of students, but I think students increasingly bring, as more and more students go to college and a larger number of students from the population go to college, more and more of those students have an instrumental view of what they want out of college, and they need a reason for what they're studying. They can't just sort of accept per se that knowing calculus is a good, and I don't know calculus. It's helps to know what problems calculus will enable them to solve, and what real problems in their lives will having that information give them the capacity to confront better and more effectively. Mm-hmm. So I think the distinction, the sort of traditional distinction between vocational education and liberal education, is breaking down, and it's not only breaking down inside colleges, it's breaking down in the corporate world, in the real world. There's a lively movement within the corporate world to develop skills and standards for hiring and entry into the workforce. And in a lot of industries, there's a lot of activity going on as to what are the knowledge and competencies that workers need to have in order to be success in our industry. And if you look at the way that the definitions are changing, they're changing in the direction of more and more complex abilities, more and more abilities that look more and more like what academicians call a liberal education. And so in the electronics industry, there was a study just recently released of what it is that students need to know and be able to do. And if you read that study carefully, it looks very much like a liberal education.
Do you perceive then in the future that there will be a liberal education, or will there be the equivalent of vocational, general, and specialty educations in the future only differently defined by tomorrow's needs?
Well, I think we've confused the notion of a liberal education with the notion of particular academic subjects like history and mathematics and biology. And I think more and more we're coming to the view that it's not the subject itself, as I said earlier, but the abilities learned in the context of learning the subject, of reasoning and problem solving and communicating effectively, whatever the subject matter, that's the key, and that's you know, important in work and in the changing character of work. And so what I see is a decreasing emphasis on the mastery of any particular subject matter and an increasing emphasis on the abilities and skills that are learned, the underlying reasoning process within mathematics and the underlying reasoning process. How is it that lawyers learn to think, mm-hmm. or that doctors learn to think, or that how does the way economists think, you know, complement differ from the way an historian thinks? And it's those modes of reasoning and learning that are becoming the kind of fundamental core of a liberal education.
Just mastery.
Mastery of the skills of inquiry, if you will.
And what about different levels and abilities of students? If in America today we're saying everyone needs a college education, is everyone going to be able to compete in that educational environment? To be able to compete once they go outside into the market, so to speak?
Well, I strongly feel that all students are capable of learning, and we sort of have a system that selects students on the basis of aptitude rather than on the basis of effort. The SATs, for example, are a classic case of a testing instrument that discriminates among students on the basis of aptitude rather than the amount of effort they can put in to master a particular subject. And I think we need to shift to a system in which we hold up very high standards and we commit ourselves to the belief that all students are capable of meeting those standards, but they need a lot of different varieties and ways of teaching and learning in order to achieve them. And I see that as possible, but it's not easy.
When you look ahead to the world of higher education, despite the pressures it's under, despite the economic troubles that may plague it in the future, are you optimistic, or do you think this is a long, hard road ahead? Or both?
Well, I'm congenitally optimistic, and I see the glass half full, and I see a lot of promising developments going on. But I think that we have a choice as a society to make about higher education, and to go back to the situation in California, which I think is the most dramatic story unfolding at the moment. In the mid 1960s, people in California made a choice to build one of the best systems in the world, and that choice is unraveling at the moment. And people are being denied access. Classes are larger. Things are you know, declining in a lot of ways. And it's not too soon or early to turn things around. And by turning things around, I certainly don't mean that the taxpayer simply has to put up more money. Mm. I think that the educators in California need to commit themselves to genuine reinvention of their institutions. But the taxpayer also needs to support that process. And whether that will happen or not, the jury is out.
On that note, mm-hmm. Russell Edgerton, thank you very much for a very interesting hour.
Thank you.
Once again, Russell Edgerton is the president of the American Association for higher education. It's a Washington, D.C.-based national organization, has about 8,150 members, administrators, and faculty in higher education nationwide, and puts out a bi-monthly magazine called Change. I'm Susan McGinnis. This has been Conversations Today with Dr. Russell Edgerton. Thanks, Russ.
Thank you, Susan.
And thank you for listening. I hope you join me again next week.